her eyes sparkling like a girl's. Even Jocelyn fared better than I did. I should have guessed it, for Siobhal is mountainous, and he was born to it. Like most men, he was happier in action than stillness. Someone had given him a bearskin cloak, and he seemed warm enough in it, riding with high-spirited élan. They say there is Bodhistani blood in the torrid lineage of Jasmine House, and I thought of my mother for the first time in many years, wondering as I shivered if this aversion to the cold came through her. On the eighth day we reached the meeting place. It was set in a great bowl of a valley, ringed about with forested mountains, with a lake at the bottom, around which the camp was arrayed. This, I understood, was Voldemar Selig's steading, which he had inherited through birth and right of arms, and built into greatness. Indeed, though still crude by our standards, the great hall was thrice the size of Gunter's, and there were two outbuildings near as big. And all around the lake, throughout the whole of the basin, were pitched encampments, bustling with the activity of varying scaldy tribesmen. We had been seen before we came within a mile of the steading. The forest had seemed virgin and silent to me, but for the occasional snap of a twig bursting in the cold. But Knut, who had much skill at woodcraft, laid a finger alongside his nose and nodded wisely at Gunter. Still, I think even he was taken by surprise when three scaldy rose from the snow in front of us, cloaked and hooded in white wolfskin, spears at the ready. In a flash, Jocelyn turned his horse sideways to the scaldy, making a rolling dismount and fetching up before them on his feet, vambraces crossed, daggers at the ready. It startled them as much as they had us, and they blinked at him, looking momentarily silly beneath empty white wolf masks that draped their brows. Gunter laughed uproariously at the sight, waving his thanes and the rest of us to bide behind him.
"So you would defend me, eh, wolf cub?" he asked. "Well and good, but don't do it at the cost of the blessed's hospitality."
He nodded cheerfully to the blinking scaldy.
"Hail and well met, brothers. I am Gunter Arnlaugson of the Marsi, summoned to the All-Thing. What is this fighting thing you have brought to our midst, Gunter Arnlaugson?"
their leader asked sourly, annoyed at being caught out.
"Surely he is no Marsi, unless the maids of your steading have been straying over the border."
Hatevik sniffed loudly, and one of Voldemar's scaldy glanced in her direction. Catching sight of me, he dropped his drawl and stared, tugging at his comrade's sleeve.
"What I have brought, I reveal only to Voldemar Selig himself," Gunter said shrewdly. "But they are loyal to me, eh, wolf cub?"
Jocelyn gave him a bland look, bowing and sheathing his daggers.
"I protect and serve, my lord."
"You will answer for them, then," the leader said, and shrugged. "We will lead you down."
"Lead on,"
Gunter said magnanimously. So it was that we descended to the meeting place with our escort, who picked their way carefully, while our horses plunged through the snow, sinking chest deep at times. If the massive encampment seemed vast from above, on the valley's floor they sprawled endlessly. A veritable city of tents had sprung up to host the All-Thing, clamouring with innumerable scaldy. They do not practice heraldry as we do, but I saw subtle differences marking the tribes in their manner of dress. The cut of their garments, the colours of their woolens, how they laced their furs. This tribe wore bronze discs for adornment, that one bear's teeth rattling on bared chests, and so on. Undeniably there was tension amid the gathering of scaldy tribes. I could feel it as we rode down the broad snow-packed aisles between encampments, passing from one territory to the next. The thanes watched, honing their weapons, and the women, who numbered fewer, eyed us speculatively. Only children and dogs seemed oblivious to the covert menace, racing, shrieking, or barking from camp to camp in a sort of endless game of chase, the rules of which are known only to children and dogs. Everywhere, though, murmurs followed us. Jocelyn and I had been oddities among the folk of Gunter Steading, who dwelt a day's ride from the Dangeline border. Here we were as misplaced as a pair of Barquis à l'envers desert-bred steeds amid a stable of plough horses.
"You will find lodging there," our guide said to Gunter, pointing to one of the smaller halls, "and you may take two of your thanes. Your headwoman and two others may lodge there, and the rest must remain in camp with your thanes."
He pointed to the other lesser hall.
"Make camp where you will. You may draw one armload of wood a day from the common pile, and one bowl of porridge at dawn and night, or forage where you will. Your horses you must tend yourselves."
The thanes grumbled, although they'd expected little better, and Gunter looked displeased at being relegated to a lesser hall.
"I wish to see Voldemar Selig," he announced. "I have much of import to relate." "You can tell it at the old thing that all might hear," the leader said, unimpressed. "But the blessed will receive tribute in the evening, if you wish it."
He pointed to the horizon.
"When the sun is a finger's width above the hill, the doors of the great hall will open."
He has a sense of ceremony, then, I thought. He understands how the hearts of men are ruled. It was an uneasy thought.
"Thank you, brother, for your courtesy," Gunter said softly.
There was irony in it, and the leader flinched slightly before it, but nodded and departed. Gunter took Hatefic aside then, speaking to her in a low voice, while the rest of us milled about. She looked at me once with sorrow in her eyes, but I saw her lips move in a word of assent.
"Well, then," Gunter said loudly, looking at the rest of us, "you will stay with me, Wolfcub, and you, Braid. For the rest, you will do what is needful, and we will meet here when the sun is two fingers above the hill, eh?"
I was left unsure of my own role, but Hatefic and another woman, Linnea, her name was, both dismounted, and Hatefic beckoned me, a kindness in her face. My homely Knut reached over to take the reins of my mount, and would not meet my eyes. Gunter and Braid had dismounted as well, and Gunter made an impatient gesture at Jocelyn. He remained in the saddle, blue eyes darting, his horse dancing a little at the pressure of his knees. If I was hard put to guess what was happening, it must be 10 times worse for him. He had come quickly to grasp rudimentary scaldic, but it was hard to hear, with everyone milling about in the open air.
"My lord, my oath is based on my lady's safety," he reminded Gunter. "She will be safe, Wolfcub," Gunter said quietly. "She goes to a king, and you with her."
Jocelyn met my eyes, and I nodded. He dismounted and tossed his reins to one of the thanes. And then Hatefic took my arm and led me away, and I could only glance over my shoulder, watching as the men went the other way, and the people stared and murmured. In the women's hall they stared no less, and there was venom in the whispering that followed. I cannot help but be grateful, in my deepest heart, for the kindness of Hatefic and the example she set for the women of Gunter's Steading. And though she had neither seniority of place nor age in the women's hall, she commanded it as if she did, bustling others out of her way and securing the bathing room for our usage. It was warm in there and humid. Linnea busied herself with filling the tub. Like Knut, she would not meet my eyes. Hatefic stood waiting and did not look away. I loosed the pin on my fur cloak and let it fall to the floor.
"What did he bid you, Hatefic?" I whispered.
"To polish your beauty so it shone," she said gently.
I undid the bindings on the furs about my legs, then unlaced the kirtle of my woolen gown, stepping out of it. "Did he tell you why?" I asked, shrugging off my underskirts of undyed wool and stepping into the tub.
"Yes," she said even more gently, then shook her head. "Child, if I could do aught about it, I would.
but 'tis a man's world we live in, for all that they give us a voice in it." I reached out for her hand then, and kissed it as I had the first day. "Hatevik, you have given me kindness, and that is more than I deserve," I murmured. This time she did not snatch her hand away, but laid it open against my cheek.
"You brought beauty to my steading, child," she said, "not just in your face, but in your manner. You listened to our songs and made them beautiful. I thank you for that."
So I had meant something to her, to the folk of the steading, and not just as Gunther's plaything. It made me weep to hear it, though I poured water over my face and showed it not. I could not afford then any more pity. I finished my ablutions, and when I had done, Linnea helped me into a gown of combed white wool. Where they had hid it, I do not know. It was a little crumpled from the journey, but the heat of the bathing room eased the creases. I sat quietly, then on a stool, while Hatevik combed out my hair, teasing out the tangles of 8 days of travel, until it fell in a wealth of dark, shining curls.
"Mark the sun where it stands," Hatevik said to Linnea.
She gave a quick nod and slipped out of the room.
"Am I ready, then?" I asked.
Hatevik gave one last flounce to my hair.
"If Voldemar Selig has seen anything like you," she said with satisfaction, "I will eat my shoes."
It was unexpected, and it made me laugh. She smiled then and hugged me roughly.
"I'll miss you, child. I will that. You and that beautiful lad both."
And then Linnea came scurrying back, an alarmed look on her face.
"They're gathering,"
she gasped, picking up our things. If I was a gift fit for princes, surely I was fit for barbarian kings. I donned my fur cloak and left the women's hall with Hatevik and Linnea, ignoring the murmurs. Outside the great hall, representatives of several steadings had gathered. We stood together, the folk of Gunther's steading, and tried to stand tall in our pride. I dare say even Jocelyn and I were no exception in this, and if I had not the height to match the Scaldi, at least I had the pride. The slanting sun cast a blaze upon the tall wooden doors bound in brass. The air grew ever more chill as it lowered. Surely enough, when the sun stood a thick finger's breadth above the tree-line, round and orange, the great doors swung slowly open. Voldemar Selig awaited us.
Chapter 46. Voldemar Selig may have grasped the uses of ceremony, but when it came to showmanship, Gunther wasn't entirely lacking in a sense of style. With his usual cunning, he allowed the members of other steadings jostling for position to precede us into the great hall. As a result, my initial impression was simply that of a great many Scaldi in one place at one time, most of them male. From my vantage point, I could see little more than a sea of brawny forms clad in furs and woolens. Apart from its size, which was impressive, the hall had nothing to distinguish it. In design it was much like Gunther's hall. There, I found myself thinking, was the kitchen, there the storerooms, and there a handful of private chambers. Still the hearth was higher than a man, and I was hard put to imagine the girth of the trees whose timber formed the rafters high overhead. Representatives from four steadings awaited audience with Voldemar Selig that evening, two of the tribe Marsi, including us, one of the Mani, and one of the Gambrivi. Many of the other tribes, including the powerful Swathi and Vandali, had arrived earlier. All, it seemed, had brought tribute. Gunther had not been alone in his thinking, or perhaps it was custom. The Gambrivi steading, a wealthy one, brought gold and much envy. Though I could not see it, I heard from the talk around me. The other Marsi steading, which had a woodcarver of great skill among its number, brought futhark rods, reckoned no mean gift. We followed the Mani of Lidolf's steading, who brought a gift of wolf pelts, a full dozen of them, snow-white and flawless. This drew a low murmur of acclaim, for the white wolves of the north are notoriously hard to hunt, and Selig's totem animal beside. His hand-picked thanes who wore the wolf pelt were called the White Brethren. I learned it there, waiting in the great hall behind the Marni. If my vision was blocked, my ears were not, and the first I learned of Voldemar Selig was his voice as he greeted those who paid him tribute. I heard it best with the Marni, being closest. He had a deep voice, and even, well-tempered, I would say, which meant he knew how to use it, and he had that good leader's trick of making every man feel singled out for welcome. Then the folk of Lidolfstedding made way, and it was our turn to come before the man who would unify the Skaldi. Gunter stepped forward, and his thanes ranged about him in a loose formation, alertly attentive. Hatevik and the women would stay behind, as would Jocelyn and I. This was a matter for Skaldi warriors first and foremost. Thus it was that my first glimpse of Voldemar Selig came between the shoulders of Gunter's thanes. I could not see his face, only that he was a large man, broad-shouldered, seated in a sizable wooden chair, like enough to a throne, but it might as well have been one. A Dangeline would have knelt. The Skaldi did not. Gunter stood straight before his war leader.
"Gunter Arnlaugsson of the Marsi, well met, brother," Selig's rich voice said, warm and welcoming. "It raises my heart to see you here, whose steading wins us glory on our western borders." "We come in good faith to the old thing," Gunter said expansively, "and to pledge our loyalty to the great Voldemar Selig. I bring you these thanes, whose spears are keen for your enemies, and Hatevik Arild's daughter, who keeps the heart of the steading alight."
Behind him, Hatevik bobbed nervously. So the Skaldi were not immune to the trappings of ceremony. I moved to better catch sight of Voldemar Selig. I saw his eyes, a greenish hazel and thoughtful.
"Be welcome among us, folk of Gunter Arnlaugsson's steading." "We too bring tribute, O blessed," Gunter said cunningly, stepping back. Hands propelled me forward, and Jocelyn beside me. "These two Dangeline slaves, purchased with gold won by Skaldi blood, I give unto you, war leader."
That Voldemar Selig had heard rumors of our arrival, I do not doubt. There was no startlement in his face at Gunter's words, but at the sight of Jocelyn and me, his eyebrows rose. This I saw clearly, for we stood full before him now, no Skaldi to bar our way. I met his curious eyes and curtsied. Not the reflexive obeisance of the Night Court, but a different gesture, one that Delaunay had taught me, the salute one makes to a foreign prince. He knew it somehow. I saw it in his measuring gaze. He was handsome enough for a Skaldi, was Voldemar Selig, tall and hale in his middle 30s, with eyes that thought in a strong-featured face. His hair was a tawny brown, bound with a gold fillet, his beard combed to two points, both twined with gold wire. He had a sensual mouth for a warrior, for a Skaldi. But his eyes, they kept their own counsel. Jocelyn swept his castelline bow, which served all purposes for him. It mattered naught. For the moment it was me upon whom Voldemar Selig's thoughtful gaze rested. I saw his eyes shift to study my own, the left one. He saw the scarlet mote and noted it.
"You'll give me two more mouths to feed, Gunter Arnlaugsson," he asked lightly.
Laughter answered, and Gunter flushed. I understood it. He did not know what we betokened, but he had not mismeasured our value. He had simply not determined whether or not he wished to acknowledge it. But Gunter was no fool, nor a man to be taken lightly.
"She is trained to please kings," he said, and paused. "My lord."
Sovereign words, and ones I uttered so thoughtlessly. Gunter did not. He had said what the Skaldi had not yet voiced. He knew. He had said as much to Jocelyn.
It was something else to say it before Skaldi, who had never had a soul ruler. I understood then the full import of his gift. He was acknowledging Voldemar Selig a king. Voldemar Selig shifted in his throne-like chair, still temporizing. He didn't need exotic furs to set him off. His movement shifted the flames in the great hearth behind him, casting light like a shadow.
And the lad?
A lord's son, Gunther said softly, and an oath-sworn warrior priest of the Dungeleens, bound to the girl. He will guard your life as his own, do you but keep her safe. Ask your thanes if you do not believe.
Is it so?
Voldemar Selig asked the white brethren, his thanes with the snowy wolf pelts draped over their shoulders, wolf masks over their own heads. They stirred and muttered. His gaze fell back to me, curious and wondering.
Is it so?
I do not think he expected an answer. Gunther had not told him I spoke their tongue. I curtsied to him again. It is so, my lord, I said in clear Skaldi, once again ignoring the sound of surprise about me. Jocelyn Varai is a member of the Castellan Brotherhood. Ganelon de la Courcelle, who is king of Terdange, does not stir, but two Castellans attend him. It was a gamble, truly. But in his demeanour, in his very self-control, I saw a hunger for a more civilized society, to impose upon his people the structures that allowed for a glory not wholly won by iron and blood. Jocelyn, following my lead, merely bowed again.
"You speak our tongue," Voldemar Selig said softly, "and trained to serve kings. What does it mean?"
Another man might have said it for effect. He meant it. His gaze probed my face.
"I would send one such as you, if I wished to tempt my enemy to foolishness. How do you say, then, that you came to be a slave?"
It was not a question I had anticipated, though I should have, knowing as much as I did of him. There is a time to dissemble, and a time to tell the truth. Looking at his eyes, I gauged it was the latter. "My lord," I said, "I knew too much." My whole history lay naked in those words, for one who knew to read it. If Voldemar Selig did not, still he recognized the language in which it was written. He nodded once, as much to himself as to me.
"That may happen," he remarked, "if one is trained to serve kings."
The great hall stirred at that. He had acknowledged Gunther's words and my own for truth. But no one disagreed.
"And what of you?"
he asked then, switching his focus suddenly to Jocelyn.
"How do you come before me?"
If I had had reason to doubt the Castellan's quickness of wit, as opposed to his propensity for swift belligerence, I could only praise him now. Jocelyn turned to me and spoke in Dungeleen.
"Tell him that I am oath-sworn to guard your life," he said. "Tell him that it is a matter of honour."
I turned back to Voldemar Selig, who held up one hand.
"I speak a little off your tongue," he said haltingly in Dungeleen. "You must speak a little of mine to hear this."
He switched then to near-fluent Kedaki.
"Do you speak the scholar's tongue, Dungeleen? I understand what you say."
Jocelyn bowed, unable to keep his eyes from widening.
"Yes, my lord," he replied in Kedaki. "It is as Gunther Arnlaugsen has said." "So," Voldemar Selig considered Jocelyn, "and do you swear, as Gunther Arnlaugsen has said, to guard my life as your own, Jocelyn, there I..."
He had marked Jocelyn's name when I spoke it, and remembered. He spoke somewhat of our tongue, albeit with a barbaric accent, and Kedaki in the bargain. The more I saw of this man, the more I feared him. Gonzago de Escabares had been right. Voldemar Selig was dangerous. Jocelyn had recovered his composure, and his face was cool and unreadable,
a mask of castling discipline. Of those in the hall, only Gunt and his thanes, who stood behind us now, knew his skill. He stood scant yards from the Skaldi leader, fully armed and on his feet. In three moves I thought he could kill Voldemar Selig, and of a surety, the tense unity that held the Skaldi at the Althing would not survive Selig's death. Fractured and leaderless, the Skaldi would be what they had always been, a threat to our borders, but one that could be pushed back by a concerted effort. And he would be forsworn, and both of us slain or worse. Carsiel had chosen damnation to remain at Elowa's side. Jocelyn would do no less.
"I swear it," he said in Caerdyci, "on the safety of my lady Phaedra no Delaunay."
"Phaedra,"
mused Voldemar Selig, glancing at me. I curtsied, conscious of the weight of his gaze.
"That is how you are called?"
"Yes, my lord."
"Phaedra, you will teach me Dungeline. I wish to learn more."
His glance moved back to Jocelyn.
"Jocelyn, we will see what kind of warrior you are."
Selig nodded to one of the white brethren, making an oblique gesture with two fingers. With a battle cry, the thane sprang at his leader, short spear extended for a killing thrust. Voldemar Selig sat unmoving. It may have been staged, I don't know, but I believed then, and I believe now, that the thane's attack was in earnest. From his own men he commanded that much obedience. Even in this they would obey. I could see Gunter's smug grin as Jocelyn went into action. Smooth as oiled silk, he slid himself between Selig and the thane, twin daggers rising to catch the shaft of the spear with its pointed head an inch shy of his heart. With a subtle twist of shoulders and wrists, he turned its course harmlessly, and in the same motion landed a level, well-planted kick to the abdomen that sent the white brethren staggering backward, his breath leaving him with a huff. With a brief bow, Jocelyn presented the spear to Voldemar Selig. To the accompaniment of snickers, the defeated thane scowled and adjusted his pelt, taking his place with his brethren once more.
"So,"
the Skaldi leader's eyes glinted with amusement. He rose, holding the spear, and placed a comradely arm about Gunter's shoulders.
"You have given me a mighty gift, Gunter Arnlaugsson," he announced loudly.
Voldemar Selig had given his approval, and the Skaldi cheered. Looking about the great hall, however, I made no mistake. They were cheering Selig, and Selig alone. There was no welcome in their voice for two Dungeline slaves. Except for the members of Gunter's steading, gazing at their faces, I saw naught to thaw my heart. Among the women there was only envy and hatred. Among the men, hatred and hunger for me, hatred alone for Jocelyn. If I had ever doubted it, I knew it now. We were among the enemy. That night Selig feasted the assembled leaders of the steadings, and you may be sure Gunter sat in close proximity to the war leader. It was a Skaldi gathering, and the mead flowed freely. There was song and boasting and politicking alike. I was there, for Voldemar Selig ordered me to attend that night, pouring mead for Skaldi chieftains from a heavy earthenware jug. I cannot tell how many times I had to refill my jug. I could count, though, the number of times I refilled Selig's tankard, for they were few. The rest of them got roaring drunk, no question, and he allowed it, but Voldemar Selig remained sober. I watched his calculating eyes and saw how he gauged the manner of his chieftains. They had presented themselves to him on their best behavior, and he had gauged them then. Now they let their true nature show, and he watched them all the closer for it. It gave me the shivers. I noted, too, how his gaze followed me, and sensed rather than saw his appreciation for the niceties of Dungeline's service. The linen cloth I held beneath the jug, the line of the arm as one paws, the proper angle of approach, the thousand and one details one is taught in the night court with which to serve with unobtrusive grace. It mattered naught to the other Skaldi, who held out their tankards at will and didn't care if the contents slopped over the sides. But it mattered to Voldemar Selig. He had Jocelyn attend too in the Castlane manner, 3 paces behind his left shoulder, hands crossed at ease on his hilts. He must have asked what was proper. Clever, but not foolish. I could see that Voldemar Selig was aware of his every move, and that 2 of the White Brethren kept a careful watch on Jocelyn. He hungers for our customs, I thought. He would set himself up as a king, but this nation of brawling drunkards is not fit for the sort of kingdom he wishes to rule. I thought of my homeland, and my blood ran cold. There was no talk that night of why they were assembled, only boasting and tales of what they had done already. 2 of the leaders, a Swavey and a Gombrivi, fell to quarrelling over an ancient blood feud, and it wasn't long before their swords were out. Drunken and excited, the Scaldi cleared way for the fight. I saw Gunter among them, bawling out a wager which was quickly accepted. It was the sound of Voldemar Selig's tankard being slammed onto the table that caught their attention and commanded silence.
"Are you men?" asked the Scaldi war leader into the abashed stillness, his hazel eyes glinting. "Or dogs, to quarrel over a dry bone? I have a rule in my household. Any man who bears a grudge, let him bring it to me. And any man who would settle it by might of arms, let him take up his cause against me. Is that your wish? You, Lars Hognesson. You, Erling the Quick."
They fell to shuffling and muttering, for all the world like 2 boys caught quarrelling.
"No? Good, then. Make peace among you, and behave yourselves as brethren ought."
Scaldi are easily moved to emotion. The 2 men who moments before were like to tear out one another's throats fell on each other's shoulders and embraced like brothers.
"Well done,"
Voldemar Selig said softly, levering himself to his feet, using his height and the breadth of his shoulders to dominate the hall.
"You are here," he told them, "because you have learnt to lead among your own folk. If you would truly be leaders of men, you must learn to unite and not to divide. Divided we are but so many dog packs, squabbling in the kennel yard. United we are a mighty people."
They cheered him then, but Voldemar Selig was too canny to rest on his laurels.
"You," he said, pointing at Gunter, "Gunter Arnlaugsson of the Marsi, did I hear you cry out a wager?"
Gunter had the sense to look embarrassed.
"It was the heat of the moment, blessed," he protested. "Surely you have done as much to warm a long winter's cold." "If a man does wager on a dogfight," Voldemar Selig said calmly, "how does his hunting pack fare come spring?"
He sat down and thrust up the right sleeve of his jerkin, bearing 1 mighty arm.
"A wager is a challenge, Gunter Arnlaugsson, and you are a guest in my hall. What will you wager, then? That stone which sparkles so prettily about your neck? A dangeline trifle, if I make no mistake."
Caught out unwitting, Gunter glanced at me. I could not help but pity him. Melisande's diamond was ill luck for anyone.
"Do you admire it?"
he asked brashly, lifting it from about his neck and holding it out to Selig.
"Then it is yours." "Ah, no,"
Voldemar Selig smiled.
"I would win it as honestly as your respect, Gunter Arnlaugsson. Come, if you would wager, try your luck against my arm."
He beckoned, and the muscles in his arm shifted like boulders beneath the skin. Deprived of a fight, the Scaldi applauded the prospect of a test of strength. Clever Selig, I thought, to catch them out with shame, then shame them with strength. They didn't know what he was about, but I did. Making the best of a bad situation, Gunter clasped his hands above his head and shook them, flashing the diamond as he stepped up to the table. Scaldi admire courage, and they rewarded his with shouts of approval. Voldemar Selig merely gave a wolfish grin. They sat down then across from each other, and Gunther laid the diamond on the table before they gripped hands and leaned into it, pitting sheer force against one another. It was not a pretty sight, that much I will say. As I had cause to know, Gunther Arnlaugsen was a powerful man, and no easy match, even for one of Selig's stature. Their faces reddened, and the tendons stood out on their necks, while their arms bulged and corded with effort. Eventually, though, it had to happen. Gunther's wrist bent back slowly, while Voldemar Selig's curved over the top of it. Inch by inch, Gunther's arm was forced to the table, until at last it struck wood. Selig's white brethren cheered the loudest, but they were not alone in it. Even Gunther had the grace to grin, wringing his hand. "You are well shed of that thing," I thought, as he picked up Melisande's diamond and presented it to Voldemar Selig. I thought too soon. Voldemar Selig dangled the diamond on its cord from one finger.
"Never let it be said," he remarked to the Skaldi, "that we are cruel masters, who fear to give the Dangelines their due, their baubles and trinkets. Let them keep what they will. Who fears a race trained to serve?"
He raised his voice to a shout,
"Phaedra!"
Trembling, I set down my pitcher and approached, sinking without thought to kneel before him. I could feel the heat coming off him without looking. "My lord," I murmured. The cord settled over my head, Melisande's diamond returning to rest between my breasts.
"See," Voldemar Selig said, "how the Dangeline kneels, to receive with gratitude what is hers by right from my own hand. See it and mark it, for it is an omen."
He grasped the hair atop my head then, raising it for all to look on my face, and they cheered.
"Look well at our future."
Gunther had given me to him as a symbol, and he was clever enough to use me as such. The Skaldi shouted and pounded their mugs, while Voldemar Selig smiled at their approval. I understood, then, the measure of his ruthlessness. What he hungered for, he would grasp, though he destroyed it in the process. Beneath his hand, I trembled like a leaf. And inevitably, damnably in the wake of this casual humiliation, came desire. If Voldemar Selig had chosen to take me in front of 4 dozen assembled Skaldic chieftains, I would have cried out encouragement. I knew it, and knowing it, wept, despising what I was. Behind it all, Jocelyn's face swam in my vision, a clear and impassive Dangeline noble's profile, staring straight ahead. I fixed my eyes upon it, and prayed. Chapter 47. On the following day, the Althing met. Voldemar Selig did not entertain me that night, to my silent relief. I was accorded a pallet among the serving women of the Great Hall, which I took to with gratitude, ignoring their sullen stares. Selig was not done with me. Of that I had no illusions. But for the moment I was content to curl up on straw and ticking, letting oblivion claim me. A sober mood prevailed after the excesses of the night. I do not know how Jocelyn fared, but we found ourselves cast together, herded into a small storeroom off the great hall, while the Althing met and the housecarls slipped about cautiously attending to them. Each leader of a steading was allowed to bring 2 thanes and his headwoman. That much I had gathered. To my dismay, the room which held us muted sound, so that neither Jocelyn nor I could hear clearly what was spoken. If blessed Eloa accorded us any mercy, it was the fact that we were alone together in the rough-timbered storeroom. The white brethren had bolted the door against us. Whatever symbol Voldemar Selig would make of his Dangeline slaves, we would play no part at the Althing. What would be spoken there was not for barbarian ears to hear. The meeting was for the Skaldi alone. I listened to the rumble and murmur of voices echoing in the vaulted rafters. Jocelyn paced about our small enclosure, testing the door, examining stored grains and ale with disgust, until determining that there was no way out
and naught of use to be found.
"How bad was it?"
he asked me eventually, leaning against a barrel and keeping his voice low.
"Be quiet," I whispered, concentrating.
It was no good. I could almost hear, but not quite. One word in 10 was not enough. Understanding evaded me. I shot Jocelyn a fierce glance, then checked, looking from him to the barrel, to the rafters. I remembered him in the street with the eglantine tumblers, and how Hyacinth and I had stood atop a barrel to watch.
"Jocelyn!"
Urgency pervaded my voice. I was already clambering atop a barrel. "Get up here and help me!"
"You're mad," he said uncertainly,
but he was already rolling another barrel into place. I stood on my toes, reaching overhead and gauging the height. "They are planning somewhat," I said calmly. "If we manage to escape and reach Isandre de la Courcelle, do you wish to tell her the Scaldi have some dire plan? But, so sorry, we couldn't hear it.
Hoist that up. We need to get higher."
He did it, protesting all the while. It took some time, for they were heavy. I kept my gaze upon the rafters. "Do you remember the tumblers?" I asked him when the barrels were in place, kneeling on the topmost. "I want you to lift me onto your shoulders and boost me to the rafter. I'll be able to hear then." He swallowed at that, hard, gazing at me from the second tier of barrels.
"Fedra," he said gently, "you can't."
"Yes," I said steadily, "I can. What I can't do is lift you. This is what Delaunay trained me for, Jocelyn. Let me do it." I held out my hand to him. He cursed then with unwonted Siovalese fluency, took my hand and scrambled up to stand beside me.
"Take my coat, at least,"
he muttered, shrugging out of it and forcing my arms into the sleeveless grey mandilion.
"Those rafters must be filthy. There's no need to tell them where you've been."
Once I had it on, he bent one knee for me to mount to his shoulders. I did it quickly, not looking down at the floor of the storeroom. It was a long way down, and though the barrels were steady as a rock, it was a precious small space on which to stand. For all of that, we might have been partners of long training. He bowed his head as I steadied myself, gripping my ankles as I rose to stand upon his shoulders. The rafter was a few inches shy of my fingertips.
"Lift my feet," I whispered down to him.
I felt his hands shifting carefully as he planted his legs under him, and his fingers gripped my ankles until the bones fairly squeaked under the pressure. I rose steadily as his arms extended into the open air, until I could wrap my hands about the great beam and swing myself up. They were mighty timbers that had built Voldemar Selig's hall. Once I had myself in place, I peered down, and Jocelyn seemed far below me atop our pyramid of barrels, his upturned face pale and nervous.
"So be it. I was there."
Lying flat on my stomach, the beams were that broad, I drew myself forward, rough splinters under my nails, reminding me with an odd nostalgia of Childeric Desarmes' whipping cross. A layer of grime and soot covered the rafter, and I was grateful that Jocelyn had given me his coat. Inch by slow, torturous inch, I progressed, until I could peer over the partition that divided our storeroom from the vast confines of the great hall. This I did, letting my sable locks fall over my face to shadow my fair skin, lest anyone glance upward. By all accounts I should have been terrified, and I was, truly, but mingled with the terror was a strange exhilaration, born of defiance and the knowledge that no matter how futile the outcome might be, I was at last pitting my skills against our enemies. It was like what I had felt betimes with clients, but 1,000 times stronger. The great hall was full to bursting, and it was cursedly warm atop the rafter with the heat of the fire and so many bodies. Some had taken seats where they could, but most were standing, including Voldemar Selig, who stood taller than any man there. I had not missed much, it seemed. A priest of Odin had asked the blessing of the Allfather and the Aesir, and the assembled Skaltic chieftains and thanes swore loyalty to Selig one by one. They were just finishing when I began to listen. Selig waited for them to be quiet,
his hands on his hips. A half-dozen of the white brethren surrounded him, making a dark spot in a pool of white seen from above.
"When our forefathers met at the Althing," he began, pitching his voice to carry, "it was to settle disputes among the tribes, to make trade and marriage, perhaps, to meet old enemies in the Holmgang, or to affirm the borders of the territories each had carved out for himself."
"That is not why we meet."
He turned slowly, surveying them all. I could see by their rapt attention that he held them in his palm.
"We are a nation of warriors, the fiercest the world has known. Kerdiki nursemaids tell their children to hush, lest the Skaldi take them. And yet the world ignores us, safe in the knowledge that our savagery is contained within our borders, turned in upon itself, that while nations rise and fall, great palaces are built and crumble, books are written, roads are built and ships are sailed. The Skaldi snarl and bite and kill each other, and make songs about it."
That drew a grumble of protest. He'd cut to the heart of sacred Skaldi tradition. I could see Selig unmoving, though he raised his voice a notch.
"It is a true thing I speak. Across our border in Terdange, the lordlings dress in silk from chin, and eat pheasant from silver plates in halls of Kerdiki marble, while we brawl in our wooden halls, dressed in hides and gnaw meat from the bone."
"'Tis the marrow that's sweetest, Selig," some wag cried.
From my perch I saw him receive a sharp elbow to the ribs. Voldemar Selig ignored him.
"In the name of the All-Father," he continued, "we are better than that. Do you seek glory, my brothers? Think on it. What glory is there in slaying one another? We must take our place in this world and make a name for ourselves. No mere bogeymen to scare children, but a name such as the armies of Tiberium won long ago, to be spoken in fear and reverence across the face of a thousand lands. No more will the Skaldi be fighting dogs on a chain, bought for hire to safeguard the passage of Kerdiki or Dangeline caravans, but rulers, at whose passage the sons and daughters of conquered nations will kneel and clutch their forelocks in respect."
He had won them over. I shuddered at the resounding cheer, gazing down at their flushed faces. Even the women, I saw with sorrow, shouted approval. Even kind Hatevik, whose eyes shone at Selig's words, imagining herself, no doubt, mistress of a marble hall, swathed in silks and velvet. I cannot blame them, in truth, for desiring. To glory in the splendor of one's homeland is a magnificent thing. But they were like children, who have only just begun to grasp the idea of a thing. And, like children, they had no notion of laboring to create, but only of having, and no thought given to the cost to others of taking it. One man, some 40 years of age, fully as broad through the shoulder, though not so tall as Voldemar Selig, spoke up. I did not know who he was then, but I learned it later. Kolbjorn of the Mani, whose thanes had been foremost in gathering information to the south.
"How do you propose we achieve this, Selig?" he asked pragmatically. "This I know. The city-states of Kerdika Unitas are on guard against us, and have made treaties to defend against invasion. There are watchtowers and garrisons from Milazza to La Serenissima, and swift roads all the way south. Tiberium may no longer command an empire, but she can still summon 5,000 foot soldiers at a courier's word."
"We showed our hand too soon to the Kerdiki," Selig said calmly.
I remembered Gonzago de Escabares's story of how King Voldemar of Skaldia had bid for the Duke of Milazza's daughter's hand. I hadn't fully credited it till now. Selig must have learned somewhat from that and grown more circumspect.
"But they are political creatures, the Kerdiki. It is the only way they retain a shadow of the glory that was Tiberium. Once we have established ourselves, they will treat with us,
and where might cannot prevail, cunning will.
He was right, of course. Any alliance among the city-states would be fractious at best. They would stand against a common enemy, but if there was political advantage to gain, well, I could guess how quickly they would outbid each other to secure the goodwill of a new potentate.
Which left Terre d'Ange, my beloved homeland. Then where and how do we prevail? Kolbjorn asked, a frown in his voice. The Dangelines hold their passes, and we have never won through in great numbers.
In the crowd I could see Gunter shifting about with eagerness. Voldemar Selig withdrew a letter from his belt and tapped it against his palm.
The Dangeline king is weak and dying, he said with satisfaction, and has no heir, but a mere woman to succeed him, and her not even wed. This offer is from the Dangeline Duke of Deglamort, whom men call Kilbahar. He would be king with our aid. Will you hear his offer?
They cried out assent, and he read it slowly, translating from Caerdyci, in which it was written, to Skaldic. I will not repeat it verbatim, save to say that it made the blood run cold in my veins. It is enough to summarize. The gist of Isidore Deglamore's plan was this. The bulk of the Skaldi would be allowed through the two southerly great passes, to lure the royal army into action and engage them in Lower Cumlach. A smaller detail of Skaldi, under the command of Voldemar Selig, would assail the northernmost pass, ostensibly to confront Deglamore and the allies of Cumlach, who would be waiting for them. They would parley and hammer out terms of peace. The Skaldi would withdraw in exchange for a beneficial trade agreement, the coastal flatlands lying north of Azal, and the acknowledged sovereignty of Voldemar Selig as King of Skaldia. The price of the peace for Terre d'Ange would be Isidore Deglamore on the throne, and if Ganelon de la Courcelle would not agree to it, Isidore Deglamore wrote privately, they would fall upon the royal army from behind and eradicate it, taking the throne by force. Lying atop my rafter, I wept in horror that any Dangeline could so betray his country, and I wept in fury for the sheer arrogant idiocy of it. Below me, Voldemar Selig folded the letter and tapped it against his palm once more, grinning at his thanes.
"It is an interesting offer," he said, "and one that would greatly increase our status. But I have a better idea."
He waved the letter in the air.
"This Kilbahar, he is a cunning man and a bold fighter. But he does not know the Skaldi if he thinks we are fool enough to settle for a peace when the whole is there for the taking. If you agree, I will answer this man and say we will take his offer and he may lay his plots. Enough men will we send to the southern passes that he thinks we have done so. And we will take ground and hold it, then retreat, and draw the Dangelines into the passes, which can be held only by a handful. So they never need guess our true numbers."
He shoved the letter back into his belt, and his hands sketched the movements in the air.
"Then we will come in numbers through the northern pass, and we will fall upon Kilbahar when he thinks to make the false parley. And it shall be we who sweep down upon the rear guard of the Dangeline army and trap them against the mountains, and we who prevail."
They were all on their feet then, roaring approval, so that the hall thundered with it. I clung to the rafter and shuddered. Voldemar Selig waited for them to settle.
"What do you say?" he asked, when it was quiet enough to make himself heard. "Shall we do it?"
There was no question of it. They were for it, the men shouting and stamping, rattling their swords. I saw here or there among the women quieter faces as they began to think of the reality of war and the numbers who would be killed. Hatevik was among them, I was glad to see. Still, none spoke against it. For the part of the men, they were all for setting out the next day. It took some doing for Selig to calm them.
"We cannot fight this war in winter," he said rationally, once they would listen. "I have read books."
He paused to let that sink in and impress them. Few Skaldi had seen a book, and most knew only Futhark, if any written tongue at all. Simple symbols carved on wood and stone.
"I have read books by the greatest tacticians of Hellas and Tiberium. One thing all agree upon, that an army travels on its belly. If we are to hold the passes, we cannot do it starving and freezing on mounts we cannot feed. It must wait until summer, when the hunting is rich and the crops coming, with good grazing and no need to build the fires high at night. Let every man go forth from the Althing and prepare for this day. Let the forges begin to work, that every man be keenly armed. Let every woman count the household stores, and make plans to supply our campaign. Do you say it shall be so? Then we will vote upon it."
I was surprised that they did this, after the loud acclaim, but they did. Selig was clever. King, some had named him, and he would even call himself, but he was yet uncrowned. Needless to say, the vote passed without dissent.
"If you have quarrels among yourselves," he said then softly, "let it be a matter of pride to settle them now. We must go into this conflict as brethren all, a glorious army. We do not go as squabbling tribesmen. Who has a case that would be heard before the Althing?"
There was some shuffling. There were quarrels, no doubt. Anyone could see it. Voldemar Selig's gaze swept the crowd.
"You, Muttul of the Vandali, it is said Halyard killed your sister's son. Do you accuse him?"
These were Skaldic matters, and of no concern to me. By the pricking of the hair on the back of my neck, I knew it was time to withdraw. I began to wriggle backward along the rafter, using my knees and elbows as best I could. It was a great deal more difficult than going forward, and my skirts encumbered my progress. Melisande's diamond hung free from about my throat, bumping against the wood. I was terrified that the glitter of it would give me away. It seemed an eternity before I was safely above the storeroom and peered over the edge to see Jocelyn tracking my progress with worried eyes.
"Get down!"
he hissed at me, holding up his arms. Now that I was out of sight of the Skaldi, the shock of what I'd witnessed struck me, and I found myself trembling. Still, there was nothing else for it. I clung to the rafter by my fingertips, lowering my body until I felt Jocelyn's hands graze my ankles.
"Let's go,"
he whispered, and I did, falling to slide through his grasp until his hands caught me hard about the waist and he set me down carefully on the barrel. We stood there like that for a moment, pressed close with nowhere else to stand, and I shuddered in his arms, face against the warmth of his chest. If anyone had told me a year ago that my sole comfort in life would be a Carseline brother, I would have laughed. I pulled back and looked up at him.
"They mean to invade," I whispered. "They mean to have it all, and that cursed Deglamore's given them a way to do it. Jocelyn, this goes far beyond border raids. We have to find a way to warn them."
"We will," he said it quietly, but with all the implacable strength of a Carseline vow.
With unaccustomed gentleness, he took my face in his hands and brushed away the traces of my tears.
"I swear to you, Fedra, I'll get us out of here."
Because I needed to, I believed him and took strength from it. The sounds of the old thing rumbled and quieted on the far side of the wall. "The barrels," I said, and drew hastily away to clamber down a tier. Jocelyn followed quickly, hoisting down the topmost barrel. We worked in tandem, urgent and silent, he doing the heavy lifting while I rolled barrel after barrel along its rim, back to an approximation of its original place. Our fear, while prudent, proved needless. We finished, and still the Althing continued, no one coming for us. I gave Jocelyn back his grey coat. He sat on his heels, working out the worst of the dirt and soot, while I scrubbed at the grime ground into my sleeves and skirts. I stole glances at him while I worked, taking solace in the haughty d'Angeline beauty I had first despised in him, the proud provincial features, and his clear summer blue eyes. He must have been thinking along the same lines, for after a time he looked up at me.
"You know, when I was assigned to attend you," he said softly, "I thought it was a punishment of some sort. I thought you were nothing but an expensive plaything for the worst of the science of the misguided."
"I was," I murmured bitterly. I touched Melisande's diamond. "I still am. Were I not, we wouldn't be here, and Delaunay and Alcuin would still be alive."
Jocelyn shook his head. "If Melisande had one plan, she had others. I've no doubt she could have gotten the information elsewhere. It fell on you, that's all."
"And I let it, and Voldemar Selig will do the same." I leaned back against a barrel, closing my eyes. "And Eloa help me, I'll welcome it when he does. While I eat my heart out with anguish, I'll prove to him 1,000 times over exactly how debauched and yielding a d'Angeline whore can be, and I'll thank him for it when he's done."
I opened my eyes to see Jocelyn blanch. He was enough of a castling to look as sick as I felt at it, but his voice when he spoke was fierce. "Then do it," he said, "and live. And when he crosses onto d'Angeline's soil, and I'm there to meet him, and plant 10 inches of steel in his guts, I'll thank him for the pleasure of it."
It made me laugh. I don't know why, except for the absurdity of his oath, given our present circumstances. I can't explain it to one who has never been a captive. Sometimes absurdity is the only thing that keeps one sane. After a moment, Jocelyn saw the humour of it and smiled wryly. And then the bolt of the storeroom was thrown back, and the White Brethren came for us. The All Thing was ended, and the Scaldi were ready to prepare for war. Chapter 48. The news rioted through the Scaldi encampment, and the fires burned long into the night, casting a flickering orange glow on the snow-covered mountainsides, while shouted war songs and the clash of spears beaten on shields rose up to challenge the distant stars. Voldemar Selig not only let them have their celebration, but opened the doors of his storerooms. Barrel after barrel of mead was rolled out. Indeed, Jocelyn and I would have had naught to stand on by morning, and hauled to distant tents by thanes staggering under the weight. I've no doubt Selig had planned for this day and laid provisions in store. In the great hall, the celebrants were hand-picked among those leaders whom Selig judged key to his plans. He was careful, too, to include the Steading's head women among them. Gunter, grinning like a boy, was among those chosen. He had made his mark with his gift of d'Angeline slaves, and his partnership with Kilbahar, Deglamore, was useful. He was not the only Scaldi chieftain to have raided for Kilbahar's gold, but he was the most successful at it. Hatevik was there, and excitement still flushed her cheeks. But there was a shadow on her, too, that touched her when she glanced in my direction. For her kindness I was grateful, but she had no words to speak against the invasion of my country, and that I could not forgive. There was no hiding the news from us, and Selig made no effort to do so, secure in the belief that we had no knowledge of the details of his plan. He kept a close watch on Jocelyn, who stood at his guard position without expression, only his pallor betraying his emotions. The White Brethren watched him closely too, and I had the impression that they were prepared to run him through if he so much as twitched. Me, Selig kept near him, as if I were a trophy marking a victory already won. It made an impact on the Scaldi, which doubtless he intended. He was not crudely possessive, as Gunter had been, but he let it be known in a dozen subtle ways that I was under his ownership. Stroking my hair as one would pet a dog, or feeding me choice tidbits from his plate and such like. I endured it, having no choice. In truth, I would sooner have been tossed over Gunter's shoulder again. Better simple ravishment than this calculating dominion, which eroded my will and filled me with fear. Always in my mind was the knowledge of the Scaldi invasion plan.
I guessed well that Selig would have killed me if he discovered I knew it. It amused him to assume a degree of risk in probing the Dangeline character. The Castellan's armed presence at his back was proof of that. Personal risk was one thing. His legend was built upon it. But he was a leader who thought. He would do what was necessary to eliminate the risk of having his entire plan betrayed. It looked as though the reveling would continue far into the night, and I began to relax somewhat against my most immediate fears, thinking Selig would again dismiss me to the care of the serving women. This time, I was wrong. He rose after the third round of songs, bidding a good night to his people, and ordering them stay and be welcome as long as they wished. Taking his leave, he paused to speak to two of the white brethren.
"Bring her to my room," he murmured, nodding in my direction.
Fear filled me like water in a drowning man's lungs. I remained in the great hall, serving mead as I had been bidden. They came for me soon, two of them, taking my arms to lead me from the hall. The Scaldy bawled out cheerful obscenities and banged their mugs. I could hear Gunter's voice among them, roaring a colourful litany of my skills, making the most of his loss. "I am Fedra Nodalorne," I thought, "born of the Night Court proper, trained by the greatest living courtesan of Terdange, dedicated to the service of Nama. I will not go crawling to this barbarian king like a slave." So it was that I walked from the hall with my head high between my guards. What the Scaldy saw in my face I do not know, but the jests fell silent as I passed. And then they brought me to Voldemar Selig. One of the